You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Lost Illusions by Maureen Ryan. This article is from the forthcoming book, Burn It Down, Power, Complicity, and a Call for Change in Hollywood by Maureen Ryan. Copyright 2023 by Maureen Ryan, to be published by Mariner Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Excerpted by permission. An inability to accept the vibe was regarded as a failing, Owusu Breen noted. My writing partner was told, the problem is, you don't think racism is funny. Owusu Breen and Shapker were assigned the episode in which Ikunoye Agbaje's character, Mr. Echo, is killed off. The actor wanted to leave the show, a situation that can be an inconvenience to producers, but is a relatively normal event. The conversation that took place when Owusu Breen and her writing partner got feedback from Cuse on their episode was not normal. The showrunner, it seemed, had been thinking about how Mr. Echo should die. Carlton said something to the effect of, I want to hang him from the highest tree. God, if we could only cut his dick off and shove it down his throat. At which point I said, you may want to temper the lynching imagery, lest you offend. And I was very clearly angry, Owusu Breen remembered. Another person who was present also recalled Cuse offering violent imagery of Echo's death in the trees in a way that immediately made them think of lynching. This person said they definitely heard the remark about the character's genitals, but does not recall if Cuse said it or if it was said by another Lost writer when the staff discussed the episode. It's possible, Owusu Breen observed, that in that moment, Cuse was trying to think up a painful death for the character and did not intentionally bring up imagery that evoked lynching. But that in itself could serve as an indicator of just how damaging and toxic the Lost culture was. Racist, sexist, and insensitive remarks were made so casually and so frequently by so many, Owusu Breen said, that it would not surprise her if Cuse brought that up offhandedly and then forgot he said it. No one had the ability to call them on this stuff, she told me. And it's terrible to this day that they get credit for any kind of racial sensitivity or inclusion. It sucks to be a person of color in rooms like that. I really felt sick at the thought of a black actor who was giving a performance of real power and stature being discussed in this way, one source said. To toss about his death with this air of gleeful, malicious punishment was troubling in terms of the treatment of the character and for Lost track record on representation. How Echo's death appeared on screen was toned down from what was discussed, this person said, but the entire experience was deeply uncomfortable, in part because in this person's opinion, the showrunners were vindictive toward their actors. In any event, not long after that conversation, we were put in the casting room and then we were fired, Owusu Breen said. She and her writing partner were told by the showrunners, you don't fit, she told me. Owusu Breen has been a showrunner herself, and she knows what that pressure cooker is like. It brings out the worst in you. The person I was in my first showrunning gig is not the person I am now. I have apologized to people because the stress is hard, she said, but this was racism. I don't know, that doesn't feel like the kind of thing that happens just when you're stressed. There was a blood sport aspect to how that room functioned. Owusu Breen said her choices on Lost consisted of I become a dick and start making jokes at people's expense, or I'm the humorless F who no one could have fun around. About 4 months in, when Shapker found her in the bathroom late one Friday and said the bosses wanted to see them, she knew they were being let go. I was so happy to be fired, Owusu Breen said. The environment on Lost drove Javier Grillo-Marchwash to quit the show after its second season. He was the only person from the show's original nucleus of writers still in the writer's room in season two. Despite the show's massive success, Grillo-Marchwash had reached his limit. He told me the writer's room was a predatory ecosystem with its own carnivorous megafauna. 2 years of what could be called the Tallahassee mentality was enough for him. The term comes from characters on the show poking fun at the Florida city. One day, the Lost offices got a letter from the mayor of Tallahassee, who gamely invited the show's personnel to visit and enclosed brochures touting the city's attractive qualities. In response, Damon told the writer's room to double down on Tallahassee, and when asked why, he replied with a straight face that the only thing funnier than punching someone in the face for no reason is punching them harder when they ask why, Grillo-Marchwash said. If you can imagine that as a management philosophy, you can understand what it was like to work on Lost. Damon once said, I don't trust any writer who isn't miserable, because that tells me you don't care, according to writer-producer Melinda Sue Taylor. During her time at Lost, Sue Taylor learned to keep eyeliner in her desk at the office. You don't want to have to go to the bathroom to redo your eyeliner. If you cry at work, you don't want people to see that you've been crying. By the time she arrived for the drama's last two seasons, she'd heard stories about how it wasn't unusual for high-level writers to speak fake Korean gibberish that they pretended was Korean and laugh about it. Given what I know about TV writer culture, I guess that sort of thing happened in other writers' rooms at the time. A different experience of Sue Taylor's being reprimanded by Kuz after she seconded one of Kuz's instructions to a director was also probably sadly common. He just totally put me in my place, she recalled. He said, I don't need you to comment on anything I've said. It was the kind of place where the lines of authority were clear. In some ways, that was beneficial. Multiple people told me that Lindelof banned Kuz from rewriting him, a decision they actually agreed with, because most sources said they thought Lindelof was a talented writer and Kuz was not. At least Damon knew what he wanted, a writer-producer I'll call Christopher told me. That said, the Lost Room was a boys' club atmosphere that was cutthroat, Christopher added. An editor once made a minor suggestion regarding a story, and according to a Lost employee I'll call Seamus, Lindelof made it clear her job would be in danger if she ever did it again. She wrote an almost offensively effusive mea culpa letter. I'm so sorry, Seamus said. Offering storytelling input to Lindelof, Seamus observed, was an absolute no-fly zone. These revelations explain a lot, namely, why a show promising an inclusive, globe-trotting adventure ended up being in its final season about a small group of men on interlocking epic quest. This is not a critique of the show's reliably excellent actors. This is about who got the on-screen focus and why. Of course, characters of color had notable or heroic moments, but over time, they were generally shipped off the island or killed off. And white male characters like Ben Linus and the Man in Black became ever more vital. The showrunner's cold treatment of Michelle Rodriguez and her character certainly stuck with Gretchen. After Rodriguez was arrested in a drunken driving incident, instead of having empathy or sympathy for her situation, they were just like, well, we'll just get rid of her. I wasn't the only critic to point out how uneven the island saga had gotten as it entered its home stretch. But many of us agreed that Ab Eterno was a blast. The episode's credited writers, Sue Taylor and script coordinator Gregory Nations, crafted a rousing adventure tale that filled in the backstory of fan favorite Richard Alpert, Nestor Carbonell. The only problem was that an episode without Lindelof's and Cuse's names on it was so well received. Sue Taylor, like most Lost veterans I've talked to, is quick to point out that working on the show was an intensely collaborative effort. The grind of making 14 to 25 episodes of TV per season, as the Lost team did, was so demanding that it was not uncommon for a number of writers to work together to get a script across the finish line. That's what happened with Ab Eterno. We had such a talented staff, Sue Taylor said. I am so grateful for everything that everybody did, but my name and Greg's name were on the script. And I did do a pass to stitch it all together and smooth things out. I wrote a bunch of the scenes, too, and I was really proud of the results. That's why she was thunderstruck when in the anteroom to Cuse's office, she heard him on the phone with Carbonell. In Sue Taylor's recollection, Cuse said to the actor, "Oh, yeah, I wrote that. I wrote most of that script." "I mean, it was a flat-out lie," Sue Taylor said. "My jaw dropped. I just turned around and walked away." She was devastated. At one point, the Ab Eterno saga took a turn for the ridiculous. Cuse and Lindelof called Nations and Sue Taylor into a room, and she recalled that they basically told us how much we owed them for letting us have our names on that script. And they implied it would probably be good if we got them a little present. So Sue Taylor went out and bought gifts for her bosses. She can't recall what she got Lindelof, probably something Star Wars related, given his love of that franchise. She said she bought Swarovski pencils for Cuse. As the episode got more and more praise, they started to get more and more tense about it, Sue Taylor recalled. I was up next in the rotation. I was supposed to write one of the upcoming episodes. We were in the writer's room. I remember Carlton walking around the table while doling out script assignments. Sue Taylor recalled feeling that he was making sure everyone was fully aware that he was skipping her. Later, when the bosses weren't around, the other writers were sympathetic, she told me. They were like, "Yes, you're absolutely being punished for having co-written that script." To this day, Owusu Breen is extremely cautious about what jobs she takes. She talks to assistants, support staff, anyone she can get hold of. "I can't work for certain people and do good work. I'm a black woman, and if you don't accept that, I can't change," she said. Lost, she added, was the most nakedly hostile work environment she'd ever experienced. When Owusu Breen and her writing partner joined the ABC drama Brothers and Sisters, they were required to attend a seminar on avoiding and preventing racial and sexual harassment. Afterward, they went up to the people who ran the seminar and said, "Have you done this on Lost? Because they actually need to be reminded of all this," Owusu Breen recalled. "They just walked away from us, like that meme of Homer Simpson disappearing into the bush. They were walking backward like, 'No, no, we haven't done that yet. We're going to.' You could tell everyone knew it was a toxic work environment, but it was a huge hit." After they were fired from Lost, they had one other deeply surreal experience connected to the show. We were taken out to lunch by executives and told there was no racism. It was just bullying, Owusu Breen told me. It was fascinating to me. Because what do you think racism is? As she sees it, we were discriminated against on the daily. Maybe they just didn't like our writing, but it's hard to tell if you're discriminated against on the daily. Why dredge all this up years later? Because working on Lost harmed a lot of people, and some are still dealing with the after effects of that personal and professional damage. It's the sort of place where the voices still ring in your head, even now, Sue Taylor said. You don't know you're in an abusive relationship until you're no longer in an abusive relationship, said Seamus. In a separate interview, Gretchen said almost the same thing, word for word. Another reason to go into all this is because, well, Lost is still around. Thanks to the streaming revolution, the shows of the Golden Age are available with a click or two. Complicating and adding necessary context to the show's influential legacy is important. Plus, the tendency to engage in hero worship of geniuses is very much alive and well. If we don't question the more damaging aspects of our conception of genius, we are doomed to repeat the past ad nauseam, and we'll get shittier entertainment. This sort of environment doesn't only poison the dynamic behind the scenes, it shows up on screen in the attitudes of the characters, their dialogue, and the stories themselves, said Grio Marshosh. It's no surprise to me that the main Latinx character in the show was frequently portrayed as feckless, ignorant, and gluttonous, and therefore the butt of countless fat jokes. It's very easy, especially 20 years after the fact, to think, well, it can't have been that bad, or someone would have done something. Let me say it loud and clear. It was that bad. And no one did anything because retribution was a constant and looming presence. What remains a foundational pillar of the industry is the fact that those responsible for huge hits often get enormous passes regarding their actions, attitudes, and management styles. Very few people who are put in positions of power get the training or oversight they need to make the workplace a positive, or at least non-miserable, experience for everyone involved. If some powerful people want to act like despots and cruel dictators, no one will stop them, despite the fact that being a decent and accountable human being in this industry is not all that hard, Owusu Breen observed. Simple decency and managerial experience, Grio Marshosh said, are not mutually dependent. I've known Damon Lindelof a long time. My career has prospered over the years for a number of reasons, but one thing that has certainly helped is knowing that powerful people like him tend to return my call, text, or email. They want to promote their projects, and they hope for good coverage. But in many cases, there's more to it than the merely transactional. We often wonder about the same things. Why some stories work and some don't. Why some careers prosper and some founder. We can lose hours gossiping about various industry trash fires. In any event, having conversations with industry people is not just useful, it's often pleasant and even illuminating. We had two conversations for this book. All in all, he spent a couple of hours talking about what went very wrong at Lost. My level of fundamental inexperience as a manager and a boss, my role as someone who was supposed to model a climate of creative danger and risk-taking, but provide safety and comfort inside of the creative process, I failed in that endeavor, Lindelof said when we spoke in 2021. In that conversation, he also addressed Hollywood tokenism that was common at the time and is still not hard to find. That's what I saw in the business around me, Lindelof observed. And so I was like, okay, as long as there are one or two writers who don't look and think exactly like me, then I'm okay. I came to learn that was even worse. For those specific individuals, forget about the ethics or the morality involved around that decision, but just talking about the human effect of being the only woman or the only person of color and how you were treated and othered. I was a part of that 1,000%. After that first conversation, I kept talking to lost veterans, and I heard awful things. It was not an easy process, because airing all of this out can feel, as Owusu Breen put it, like revealing Santa doesn't exist. People just love Lost so much. I talked to Lindelof a second time in 2022 and shared additional allegations I'd heard, many of which touched more deeply on matters of race and gender. Multiple sources, including some who heard it said in their presence, had told me they'd heard Lindelof say he fired Perrineau because he felt accused of racism by the actor. I told him the two versions of this remark that I'd heard ended with, "So I fired him," or "So I fired his ass." What can I say, other than it breaks my heart that that was Harold's experience, replied Lindelof, who said he did not recall ever saying that. And I'll just cede that the events that you're describing happened 17 years ago, and I don't know why anybody would make that up about me. Lindelof said the rapid growth spurt of Malcolm David Kelly, the actor who played Walt, Michael's son, factored into the showrunner's thinking about what to do with both characters. "When I shared Perrineau's comments about black families, missing black boys, and Hollywood stereotypes," Lindelof replied that there was a high degree of insensitivity towards all the issues that you mentioned as it relates to Harold. Lindelof added that by the second season, every single actor had expressed some degree of disappointment that they weren't being used enough. That was kind of part and parcel for an ensemble show, but obviously there was a disproportionate amount of focus on Jack and Kate and Locke and Sawyer, the white characters. Harold was completely and totally right to point that out. It's one of the things that I've had deep and profound regrets about in the two decades since. All in all, Lindelof said, I do feel that Harold was legitimately and professionally conveying concerns about his character and how significant it was that Michael and Walt, with the exception of Rose, were really the only black characters on the show. Lindelof told me he didn't remember any negative incident with an editor, adding that he seeks out input from collaborators and that he's never threatened anyone's career. Lindelof also said he had no recollection of anything Sue Taylor said about events connected to Ava Terno. He said she was a great writer who executed at a high level, and he's stricken that she was made to feel the way she felt at that time. Regarding the other allegations leveled at him and the show, Lindelof said he had no memory of the incidents and comments I related. He told me he was shocked and appalled and surprised by the incidents I described to him, and said more than once that he did not think anyone was making anything up. I just can't imagine that Carlton would have said something like that, or some of those attributions, some of those comments that you shared. I'm telling you, I swear, I have no recollection of those specific things. And that's not me saying that they didn't happen. I'm just saying that it's literally baffling my brain that they did happen and that I bore witness to them or that I said them. To think that they came out of my mouth or the mouths of people that I still consider friends is just not computing. For his part, Hughes said, he was not present for, nor did he hear, the litany of offensive comments that I brought up, and he added, I deeply regret that anyone at Lost would have to hear them. They are highly insensitive, inappropriate, and offensive. Hughes, who supplied written answers to my questions through a PR representative, also stated he had never made an actor cry. Hughes's comments were similar to Lindelof's on the matter of Kelly's growth spurt and how it collided with the island drama's plot. Kelly's rapid growth created continuity problems for Lost, hence the need, cited by both showrunners, to write him out of the narrative. And if Walt was gone, Hughes said the only thing to do with Michael was to make finding the boy his primary mission. However, since Kelly was not coming back, that was not a storyline they could resolve for the character, Hughes added. We did not know how to solve this problem, other than to resolve Michael's story at the end of season two. Cuse also stated that he never discussed matters touching on race at any time with Perrineau, and that race had nothing to do with the character's storyline. I do not believe he is in any way personally to blame for the way his role changed, said Cuse, who also noted that Perrineau's feedback about that script was relayed to him by Lindelof. Cuse did not recall discussing those specific concerns with the actor. And that revisions of the script were in part intended to address Perrineau's input. We heard his concerns and made changes to address them in the second episode of season two. And as we moved through season two, we reflected Michael's character as caring deeply about finding his missing son at every possible opportunity, Cuse wrote. In his responses, Cuse disputed that Perrineau was fired. He said the actor was bumped down to recurring status, but that does not line up with Perrineau's recollections. The actor said after season two, he was released from his lost contract and took other jobs. As the opening credits show, he was not part of season three at all. Perrineau did appear in several episodes of the strike-shortened fourth season, and he also appeared once in the final season. As for Cuse's remark to Owusu Breen about Mr. Echo's death, this was Cuse's response to a query about it. I never, ever made that statement above, and this exchange never happened. To further add to this lie and suggest that someone was fired as a result of a statement that I never made is completely false, adding that the implication is completely outrageous. Hundreds of people were employed in various capacities by Lost. Some had, at times, genuinely positive experiences, and that was and is a good thing. But in the engine room of the show, where decisions about theme, story, and focus were made, where characters and plots duked it out for attention, the atmosphere was often demeaning, unpleasant, and confounding, at least to some. One person said of their bosses and some of their co-workers, I think they were having a different experience of reality, which was, wow, I just have a bunch of funny people I work with. This source felt silenced because it felt as though every pathway, other than accepting the cruelty, sexism, and racist commentary, was blocked. I kept a running list of words sources used to describe the show's work atmosphere, a word cloud I shared with Lindelof and Cuse. Among the adjectives that came up a lot, cruel, brutal, destructive, racist, sexist, bullying, angry, abusive, and hostile. It breaks my heart to hear it. It's deeply upsetting to know that there were people who had such bad experiences, Cuse wrote to me. I did not know people were feeling that way. No one ever complained to me, nor am I aware that anybody complained to ABC Studios. I wish I had known. I would have done what I could to make changes. I also asked Cuse the following question. It's my understanding that there were several tiers of compensation among actors on Lost, and that after negotiations during the show's run, white actors were in the top compensation tier. Why was that? Cuse wrote that he and Lindelof steadfastly believed that the actors' compensation should all be the same. While we did not support changes to how the actors were compensated, ultimately those decisions were made by ABC Studios. He wrote that he did not recall withholding a script from Sue Taylor, whom he called an invaluable asset to Lost. Nor did he remember claiming credit for Ava Turner or implying that she should buy presents for the showrunners. He called the latter claim absurd. Regardless of our level of rewriting on Ava Turner, we never sought credit for our work on the episode, Cuse wrote. As for the high writer turnover, which he acknowledged especially affected early seasons, He wrote that the complexity of the show's narrative, themes, and logistics made it very difficult for us to find writers who could accomplish all the many things we felt we needed from them. Looking back, I can understand that the high degree of writer turnover caused hurt, resentment, and frustration, and I am sorry for that. After I read the word cloud to Lindelof, he was silent for about a minute. He finally answered, referring to his behavior in the present. "The way that I conduct myself and the way that I treat other humans who I am responsible for and a manager of is a byproduct of all the mistakes that were made. I have significantly evolved and grown, and it shouldn't have had to come at the cost and the trauma of people that I hurt on Lost." Lindelof asked, "Would it shock you to learn or believe that despite the fact that I completely and totally validate your word cloud, that I was oblivious, largely oblivious, to the adverse impacts that I was having on others in that writer's room during the entire time that the show was happening?" He also asked, "Do you feel like I knew the whole time and just kept doing it?" I gave him a variation of an answer I have given, or wanted to give, to powerful people many times. I think he knew enough and chose not to do anything about it. But in our culture, phrases like, "I didn't know, there was so much going on, and mistakes were made," are common ways to frame terrible patterns of behavior, many of which are the result of terrible decisions, not the work of the disembodied hand of fate. Especially if the person at the center of those mistakes is a high-status individual, a lot of hedges and rationales are rolled out, and they are often couched in the passive voice. In the past decade alone, how many times and in how many important spheres have we seen wealthy or powerful people, especially white men, depicted as stumbling bumblers who knew not what they did? But someone in their early 30s, as Lindelof was when Lost took off like a rocket, is not a child. Lindelof and Cuse were adults when the show began, and both had been in the industry for years. They were the two people within that workplace who had power, and they bear the responsibility for the culture you read about here, one that endured for 6 seasons. Nothing that happens consistently across the making of more than 100 episodes of television happens by accident. Whether or not Lindelof and Cuse were present for every damaging incident, the workplace environment at Lost was created, rewarded, and reinforced by them. I said as much to Lindelof. "Of course," he replied. "Yeah, full stop. Of course, you're right." Toward the end of that second conversation, Lindelof began speculating about what would happen to his career as a result of this book. He sounded as demoralized as I felt. "It's not for me to say what kind of person I am," he said, "but I will say this. I would trade every person who told you that I was talented. I would rather they said I was untalented but decent, rather than a talented monster." That is a false binary. People can be talented and decent. Lindelof's framing is one I encounter a lot, and it belies, or at least hints at, the fundamental belief that if you're a genius, you're more or less required to be a monster. But at its heart, and at its best, it has a palpable beating heart. Lost tries to say that none of us have to be defined by our past. We're at the beginning of the entertainment industry's shift to better models, and to make the necessary changes, a lot of people must work hard on a number of fronts for a long time. But what choice do we have? As the Lost saying goes, live together, die alone. picture perfect. A new volume of portraits by photographer Slim Ahrens, including never-before-seen work, reanimates a lost world by David Friend. Opening photo, guests around the pool at Boulder Rain, the hillside home of oil executive Carl Haugard, Carefree, Arizona, 1973. George Ahrens, everyone called the 6'4" New Englander Slim, had the good fortune to make pictures for magazines from the 1940s to the 1990s. His work filled the glossy show books of the day, Life and Holiday, Town and Country, and Travel and Leisure, and on occasion Vanity Fair. His sunny portraits of post-war affluence captured the habits and habitats of the elite and of the wider stylish class, whose socialites commingled with bohemians and trendsetters. Decades later, those same images from another era, through their buoyant mood and almost fetishistic attention to detail, have continued to hold sway over today's influencers in the worlds of fashion, design, and advertising. A group of tastemakers who simply can't get enough of Ahrens' idealized depictions of the good life. Next photos, Lily Levy set sail on Lake Como, Italy, 1955. Marianne Faithfull and Mick Jagger at a party at Castletown House, Ireland, 1968. Sun worshippers at La Concha Beach Club, a resort known for its pink and white decor, Acapulco, 1975. The last time I saw Slim was Memorial Day weekend, 2006. He was at a VA hospital not far from his home in Katona, New York. 89 and failing, he was dozing in a corridor when his daughter, Mary, and I came to visit. He was sitting upright, nattily attired in a navy blue fisherman's cardigan. He squeezed our hands, but that was the extent of our communication. After several strokes, he had largely shut down. Though his face was wizened, Slim seemed impish. He still had the apple cheeks that harkened back to his days as a simple New Hampshire farm boy, as he liked to say. That afternoon, a brass band played on the patio. Wheeled out for the festivities, Slim rat-a-tapped his toes to the beat. The next day, Slim passed away peacefully. Bidding the world farewell in a VA hospital, after observing one last Memorial Day, was entirely fitting. At the start of World War II, he enlisted in the Army, became a photographer for Yank magazine, and often found himself behind the wheel of a Jeep, shuttling photojournalists from life to the front. I met Slim in the 1990s when I was Life's director of photography. In short order, he would cover heavy combat himself, winning a raft of medals, including a Purple Heart, which he claimed to have given away to a blonde whose name he couldn't recall. When he returned stateside, however, he was weary of war, and he made a vow he'd seen enough conflict. Thereafter, he insisted, in a phrase that became his leitmotif, he'd allow himself to photograph only attractive people who were doing attractive things in attractive places. And so he did. Even as war zones continued to beckon his pals from life, such as Robert Capa, David Douglas Duncan, and Carl Midyans, Slim turned his lens on the playgrounds of Gestad and Mallorca, Bali and Beverly Hills. With his mischievous smile, blithe spirit, and a knack for self-deprecation, he came across as a little boy lost. His gangly frame helped endear him to his new acquaintances. As a result, he was forever being taken under the wing of the society hostesses, power brokers, and movie stars he photographed. Gary Cooper, Clark Gable, and Alfred Hitchcock became buddies. Hollywood doyenne Jane Howard, herself an accomplished photographer, became a mentor. Inevitably, his new companions, pleased at how flattering they appeared when Slim's pictures were published, would make introductions for him to their friends, a studio head, a Vanderbilt, the Duchess of Montesquieu of Frassinsac, and on it would go for half a century. Slim's subjects were socialites and literary lights, royals and moguls, ingenues and artists, with the occasional gadabout thrown in for good measure. By depicting these well-heeled, well-turned-out men and women in leisure settings, yachts on the Caspian, ski chalet in Verbier, and in their native attire, sundresses, smoking jackets, hunting gear, he transformed his subjects into stealth-style icons. Over time, he became renowned for using vibrant color portraiture to convey the casual chic and personal style of the mid to late 20th century ruling class. Among Slim's advantages was his own narrative. He passed himself off as a loner, a kind of itinerant, dreamy rascal out of Huckleberry Finn or Our Gang, who had been raised as an orphan and was estranged from his extended family. He also came across to those he photographed as being one of them, a sophisticate, a man of the world, and, if pressed, a Gentile. Another plus was his unfussy style. When on assignment, Slim kept his camera gear trim. He worked without strobes or flashes. "I prefer available light," he said. Or photo assistants. He lugged and loaded his own cameras. All he required, he once told me, was to bring along a beautiful girl Friday, a great-looking researcher, a smasher, who could monopolize his subject's attention, while Slim, freed from scrutiny, could focus on his photographic prey. Slim liked to arrive early and sometimes stay until martini time, as the setting sun kissed the contours of the scenes around him. His midday photos, as a consequence, can appear airy and bright. His sunset shots, luminous and golden. His streamlined way of working created immediate personal chemistry, letting him establish trust through intimacy while playing to his strong suit as an affable raconteur. Another of Slim's specialties was spontaneity. He photographed in a time before stylists and brand managers, before the Aristos and Aravist had a covey of flax and personal assistants. As a rule, he rendered people in outfits they had conjured up on the spot for the shoot. Cabana casual Bill and Babe Paley in Jamaica, Bahamian vacationers in tennis whites, poet Gwendolyn Brooks in a white cowl-neck sweater on her Chicago staircase, Viscountess Harriet de Rozier in a floral print next to a vase ablaze with color. Bedecked in their own clothes and accessorized by their individual taste or breeding or worldly accomplishments, they were allowed to put their best faces forward, to pose and preen, to express an outward elan. As a consequence, Slim's subjects were always presented at their finest, at parties or poolside or both, at resorts, in repose, in regalia. The world recorded by Slim Aarons, thanks to his instantly recognizable body of work, writes social historian Nick Folks in an essay for a new book, Slim Aarons, The Essential Collection, an expansive collection edited by Sean Waldron and featuring more than 400 photographs, many previously unpublished, has come down to us in all its sybaritic splendor, shorn of the miseries that infect even the best-lived lives. The pictures, Folks notes, do not even show the sunburn and mosquito bites. Instead, they present the world of the perennial perfect moment. As an added flourish, there was Slim's fixation on the tiny design element that would give each frame an extra layer of texture, color, nuance. The throw pillow, the pocket square, the pink and white pool float. His eye looked fondly on every jot and tittle that passed his aperture. He also had, I might add, a roving eye. I recall a lunch at his farmhouse in Katona, for instance, when I watched Slim flirting with my wife. At one point, he stopped to compliment her on the embroidery of her scarf, and in an instant, he sprang from the table, clambered up the stairs, and returned with a gift. It was a cotton neckerchief from 1944. Slim was partial to ascots himself. "I got six of these when the Americans liberated Paris," he explained, pointing out the red, white, and blue design, common to both the French and U.S. flags. "You take this one," he told her. "I always wear mine on planes, which get so drafty with those overhead vents." Back in the day, if you were a stodgy titan of industry, you hired Bachrach Studios for your formal black and white portrait. But if you were stratospheres above all that, Slim errands came to you, cameras in tow, on assignment for a national magazine. Ingrid Sishi, the art and fashion eminence, once told me that magazines had one attribute that was both a blessing and a curse, their currency. Weekly and monthly publications, she explained, uniquely captured contemporary history and styles and trends, but their ultimate value was fleeting, perishable. Indeed, for much of Slim's career, his photographs were throwaways in a throwaway medium. Next photographs, poet Gwendolyn Brooks on the back staircase of her home, Chicago, 1960. Partygoers at the Desert House, designed by Richard Neutra for retail magnate Edgar Kaufman, Palm Springs, 1970. Designer Lawrence Peabody and his son Thomas at Boadicea, the family Villa Haiti, 1975. A coffee break after a few morning runs, North Conway, New Hampshire, 1955. Slim Hyatt in the DJ booth at what many considered New York City's first discotheque, Shepherd's Nightclub, 1964. And sunbathers gather along a pier at the Lido, Venice, 1957. His images served as real-time nostalgia, hardly destined for the history books or museum walls. But in 1974, a lone volume of his work, lavishly printed in Milan, was published by Harper & Row. Called A Wonderful Time, its print run was modest and sold some 20,000 copies. Through the 1970s and 80s, however, advertising and consumer culture evoked a desire among members of virtually every stratum of society to be able to attain the privileges and trappings of the kind depicted through Slim's lens. Luxury goods, mid-century modern furnishings, smart cash wardrobes. Slim's portraits gave readers not only a glimpse inside the cloistered bastions of the cultivated, but also provided a template for a lifestyle to which magazine readers could aspire. Just before social media took off in the 1990s and early 2000s, and the taste for good taste and fine design became the rage and then the rule, copies of A Wonderful Time proved to be rare collector's items, selling online for thousands of dollars. Photographers, art directors, and stylists who hadn't managed to unearth one could be spotted at Gallagher's, the vintage magazine store on 12th Street in Manhattan's East Village, thumbing through dog-eared editions of Holiday, searching for some Slim Aaron's inspiration. Slim's photographic prints became coveted. The fashion crowd flocked to his exhibitions. Billionaire Mark Getty, co-founder of the photo agency Getty Images, came calling at the Aaron's homestead in Katona and, for just shy of a cool million, persuaded the photographer in a single afternoon to part with his entire archive. In rapid succession, new books were published. A documentary was made. People were beginning to understand. Slim had reduced the essence of a vanishing age into its tincture, a kind of high life mood board that also informed the aesthetic of the here and now. Several weeks after Slim's death, Mary called me. She had just received the strangest email. A woman, a long-lost cousin, was reaching out on behalf of the extended Aarons family, whose members Slim had disavowed years earlier. With Slim gone, she wanted to make contact. Slim, she said, later providing documents and photographs, was not who he professed to be, a free spirit estranged from his parents. In fact, Slim's father, Sussman Aaronowicz, also known as Charlie Aarons, had largely distanced himself from the family. His mother, Stella Karvetsky, had been dispatched to a sanitarium. Young Slim, evidently not knowing what had become of either parent, had been raised at different times by an aunt in the tri-state area, an orphanage, and with his grandmother and cousins in New Hampshire. The man who would go on to make his living recording the high wasp look of the second half of the 20th century turned out to have been Jewish, the son of Yiddish-speaking immigrants who had lived in a tenement on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Somehow, at some point, Slim had chosen to concoct a more dramatic origin story, the vagabond waif turned bon vivant. He had dazzled acquaintances, courted the high and mighty, and ended up chronicling a world that might have otherwise been lost had it not been for the magnetic pull of his personality, his camera's forgiving eye, and the singular allure of glossy magazines. Photographs from Slim Aarons, The Essential Collection by Sean Waldron, published by Abrams, available October 3rd. Photographs, copyright 2023, Slim Aarons, Getty Images. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.